This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
We were thinking today to actually kind of reach, kind of brought one or two or three adjustments that we could share and discuss. So that would be basically the kind of the content of this working group.
Thanks for the invitation. My name is Orkan Talhan. I'm a faculty in fine arts at the University of Pennsylvania. And when I respond to the term, my question was again, you know, adjustment, extraordinary adjustment, and how are we going to see this in relationship to, evasions of power? But can we see them as separate from each other? Is adjustment and evasion are always necessarily complementary, or do we have to see them? Can we separate them from each other? But then I step back and start to look at, you know, they're all temporal scales. We need temporal scales to look at adjustment and revolutions. I mean, if you zoom out long enough, the human life is 70 years, something with something, but if you look at centuries, you know, it's something else. If you zoom out thousands of years, adjustment becomes something completely different. You know, tectonic adjustment is something else, symbolic adjustment is something else, social adjustment on hundreds of years is different, language and linguistic adjustment is something else. So it's radical, but it's also not radical in the sense that, you know, it's inevitable that things evolve and things change. And one example would be, for example, Bataille's notion of adjustment. I mean, all living things expand and adjust for the sake of survival, right? It's not symbolic in that sense, but things move on, things accumulate, and things expand, and eventually we survive by expanding and expanding and adjusting. So life itself is the motivation of adjustment. So before even arriving to anything related to, you know, evasion, I think the drive to evolve and drive to expand, drive to live, is the adjustment itself. So how can you divorce that from any other cultural activity or any social activity? Because everything adjusts at the end. And I think radicality is, in that sense, impossible. Because in the longer term, everything has its own time scale, and, you know, things evolve in their own time scales. And I think it's hard to talk about any form of radicality if you really zoom out to this thing. And then if I see this in relationship to the evasion of power, nothing really is designed to give away power. This is our invention. Design is our way of expanding and finding ways to, you know, build constructs and design and make propositions. And in that sense, evasion is probably giving up your ability to design. So life itself is going one way, but design is actually giving away that design, that power, because that's how you negotiate your presence with the others and expandability itself. So my response would be really, how can we really rethink the notion of revolution, change, and expansion in very long term, not only like 50 years, 70 years, or 100 years, but in the whole scope of humanity, like where this thing is going, and eventually, you know, maybe 2,000 years later, it will be a completely different discussion. You know, how do you think about literary adjustment or linguistic adjustment when you really look at it in a very long term? What are the consequences of that adjustment in very long term? So thinking very small moments or pockets of resistance or radicality in short term may not be the real motivation. You know, where is this really heading to? How do you initiate long-term change when you look at really zoom out, as opposed to really being reactionary to the immediate forces of the immediate forces that you confront with? But I don't want to take up the whole thing, so maybe I'll respond to different, you know, people when.
My name is Annie Frederick. I'm the executive director of Hester Street Collaborative. And I think I'll kind of focus on the very practical applications that I see in our work. We're constantly partnering with community-based organizations, social justice organizations on land use campaigns. And so I think of the notion of adjustment and evasion as sort of two different ways of operating in relationship to the power structures that the folks that we partner with are trying to shift or change in some way. And I think of, you know, different situations often require different strategies. So, you know, I think of when campaign demands are being developed and when there's sort of a target that's being developed in a campaign, it often requires along the way a sort of adjustment as one kind of interacts with these different kind of bureaucratic systems of power, and it often requires even infiltrating those systems in some way. And I think so the demands are this kind of constantly changing target, and so one kind of concrete example I can think of is working with tenants and organizations in Chinatown and the Lower East Side that want to have a voice in shaping kind of their public spaces. And when we first encountered the Parks Department, the New York City Parks Department, we found this incredible resistance to kind of meaningfully integrating kind of the needs and aspirations of the residents, or even opening up a conversation kind of where you know, different, you know, language speakers, you know, the immigrant community can actually have a voice in that process. And so we had to sort of adjust our strategy rather than proposing to kind of engage people in a design process around their park or playground. We had to say, well, how about if we just, you know, start a conversation? And we had to sort of find the way in to be able to channel those voices. And, you know, and as we began to work with the Parks Department, we began to see sort of like a softening of this kind of bureaucratic entity that would happen over time. And so we started to think about, well, how do we actually think about, you know, this idea of the short term and the long term? How do we not only, you know, get these voices included in kind of the dialogue around how their land, you know, how the public spaces in their community are shaped, but how do we build, how do we change the system? You know, how do we address this sort of more systemic issue within the agency? So that required a different, you know, adjustment of the strategy and a kind of going within the power structure to sort of affect it from within. So how could we create a sort of set of tools and processes that would not only be able to be adopted by the sort of community-based organizations that we work with on the ground, but also by you know, the Parks Department itself. And so that kind of shift in an adjustment and strategy of kind of pushing from the outside, but also then working from within, was necessary actually to sort of affect change and to open up the process. And now the Parks Department has adopted this participatory design toolkit, which they'll be using kind of citywide. So, and then I think of sort of evasion as often kind of when we're, you know, working outside the context of any of these power structures, and we're kind of, you know, coming in and doing almost more kind of guerrilla work, where you're not sort of getting approvals, and that work can be incredibly empowering and effective for the people who are involved, but you know, ultimately the challenge is how do you link that with this sort of longer, you know, systemic change and this sort of the long view, so.
My name is Jakub Orcsos. I'm the director of the Penverd Voices Festival. It's a literary festival with a human rights agenda. And I was actually thinking about the relationship between adjustment and radicality. It's, I kind of argue for the radical nature of adjustment. If you really boil it down to the personal level and think about it, it could be a revolutionary move on a daily basis. I, again, going back to to practical questions. I'm working on a literary festival. My role and my mission is to, or our mission is, to actually phrase and rephrase literature on a daily basis, meaning to be able to convince writers to, rather than just represent themselves and kind of promote themselves, we are constantly asking them to adjust their own notion of their own work and their own involvement in the literary world. So rather than just having a book in their hands and launching that book on a kind of, you know, at every event, we are asking them to go deeper, to think about their involvement, kind of adjusting their roles, their personal involvement in a larger framework of society, of any major burning issues what we're trying to deal with. And that could be revolutionary. And the refusal can be absolutely galvanizingly revolution. There are people who are totally, totally rigid, and they just can't absorb this notion. And there are people who can do this personal adjustment on a daily basis. So this, to me, it's. I don't think we need revolutions per se, but we need to see adjustments from a different perspective. And if we tie them together, we may end up to see a revolution, kind of like a revolutionary wave. So the task is to, as you said, to zoom out and see the tiny bits of personal adjustment and being to able to connect them and see a larger wave and recognize it and embrace it. And that's when you need stamina. That's when you see that wave and you recognize that wave, that's when you have to embrace it. And that's not easy. It's never easy.
Okay. I'm Eduardo Calava, and I'd like to first thank the organizers of this and the editors of the book, Catherine, Serjan, and Aaron, for bringing us together to talk about these things. I was thinking as I was hearing everyone speak that I might have to adjust my own plan, which was somewhat suggested by Aaron when he told me to come in with three examples. So I don't know if I will keep to three examples, but I've already, in relation to what's been said, in any case, decided to alter some of the examples. So one of the things that I thought I would do for reasons of economy is just cite a series of questions that are near the opening of the contribution that I made to the book, just for a kind of context for the three examples that I will give. So at a certain moment, I'm talking about the difficulty of escaping the power of tradition, partly because of the fact that we always use a language that isn't just ours, and that we follow a kind of script whenever we act. So here are the questions that I had asked. Can we really depart from the existing social system or from the relations of power in which we are always implicated? What would it mean to evade power, to skirt it, to get around it, to escape its force or vigilance? Why must such efforts at evasion remain plural, unable to stand secure in the finality of a single gesture? Why must they be multiplied and repeated? In what way is such multiplication and repetition even required in the very effort to overcome what we call power? And how does this fact imply the inevitability of a return, of a complicity that nevertheless forms the precarious condition of all activist reform? Is it the case that what is at stake is not simply the possibility of avoiding power, of stepping away from it, but also the necessity of registering the many ways in which such evasions themselves belong to power, extend or reinforce it, are perhaps even required by it, especially when it wishes to disguise or hide itself, dissimulate its force or presence? Is it possible that the very evasion of power is one of power's most powerful signatures, its most effective means of installing and continuing its reign, Or does the evasion of power suggest that power bears within it its own evasion and destruction? And the three examples that I wanted to give, the first two are quite, let's say, telegraphic, quick, and the other one is maybe more elaborate. But as I said, I've adjusted these examples in relation to what I've heard. The first is from Frederick Douglass's 1845 slave narrative, which is called The Life of Frederick Douglass, The Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave. And there's a moment in the narrative, it's a very famous moment, when Douglass is explaining how he came to learn language, how he came to acquire language. He's just moved from the plantation to Baltimore. He has a new mistress. The mistress has never had a slave before, so at some level she's illiterate in what it would mean to have a slave. So she sits him down and starts teaching him the ABCs. The master comes in, sees his wife teaching the little Douglas how to read, and he goes into a rage, and he tells the mistress, his wife, you can't teach a nigger how to read. If you teach a nigger how to read, he won't be a nigger anymore. And the little Douglas, and he goes through a whole list of rants, the little Douglas at a certain point says that the vehemence with which the master so much didn't want him to read, didn't want him to learn to read, alerted him to the pathway to his freedom. So there's a way in which, what I'm interested in there is the way in which he takes the language he hears, the language he inherits, recontextualizes it, and moves it against the master. That's an adjustment. It's a strategy. You take the language that is there, that is always preceding you, you reconfigure it, and you try and redirect it somewhere else. It's a political strategy, and it has consequences. And I think part of the consequences are something like this, I would say, is that there's this hope in the three examples I will give, that if you can change one's relation to language, you can perhaps change much more than just language. You can change the relations in which we live. So the second example is from, and I'm totally capable of adjusting the example, so if you want me to stop at any moment, since Aaron knows once I get started talking, I threaten to go on like a river forever. But the second example is from Paul Celan. It's a poem he wrote called Mit Brief und Uhr, with letter and clock. And it's a poem that is about, it's a poem that wants to awaken you to the dangers of the rhetoric of awakening. I mean, Celan is somebody who's always nervous about the fact that he's using the German language, which for him was a language that was mobilized and used to murder millions. So he's very cautious when he writes. But he wants to awaken you to the danger of the rhetoric of awakening. So he writes this poem, which begins with the word vox, which is wax. And what you see through the movement of the poem is a series of words that are like the words vaxen, which means to grow, or erwachen, which means to awaken. And so it's almost as if he's trying to accumulate different connotations around the sound vox that evoke the figures of awakening and growing, because he wants to grow the number of connotations to vox, but he also wants you to hear, like a kind of secret, these references to awakening and growing, because of course the slogans of the fascist regime were Deutschland erwache, Germany awake. So he's very cautious, but nevertheless feels that it's urgent to signal this language. So you have another example in here where someone is taking the language he inherits, evading certain words because he thinks they've been totally contaminated, but at the same time asking you to hear the connotations and associations of the sounds he gives you, with the implication that if you don't hear erwache and wachsen in vox, you have too much wax in your ears. Okay, so that what he tries to do again is take the language he inherits, recontextualize it, reconfigure it, and move it somewhere else. The last example, which is a little more elaborate, so I'll try and make it as quick as possible, is Benjamin's work of art essay, which is an essay that I always understand as an essay about how one can can negotiate, navigate one's way in a moment of danger. Okay. What it would mean to read and to read historically in a moment of danger. And I read the essay as a kind of training manual, in fact, on how to read historically in a moment of danger. It's an extremely citational essay. I mean, if one had time, we could track all the ways in which he's just citing and reciting a series of passages, both from himself and others, as a way to stage and enact what he wants to convey, which is, first of all, that we use a language that is never just, strictly speaking, ours, which is why we always run the risk, without our knowing it, of reinforcing and reiterating the very forces and systems we wish to overcome, which for Benjamin is what danger is. He's very specific what danger is in the theses. The danger is the always present possibility that without your knowing it, you can reiterate and reinforce the very thing you want to go against, which is why he says the danger is to the possibility that you can become a tool of the oppressors. So if you track what he says in this essay, which is about the work of art in the age of technological reproducibility, of course, one of the things that he says is that this is not just an essay about the work of art, precisely because he's living at a moment when the German nation, the fascist regime, is declaring itself a Gesamtkunstwerk, a total work of art. It's declared with all the associations that go with that. I, Germany, am a total work of art. I am original, I'm creative, I'm mysterious, etc. And so every time that he's talking about the work of art, what he's really trying to do is push against the way in which the German nation is describing itself as a total work of art. So when he goes through the essay, he again, recirculates a lot of the discourses surrounding the work of art, its erratic character, its originality, its creativity, in order to suggest that the work of art is never original. It's a mass of relations. Every work of art already bears within it the traces of a whole network and web of affiliations and relations. And this is his way of trying to interrupt the mobilization that he sees taking place with the fascist regime, which in effect for him is mobilizing the technical media, film, photography, radio, etc., in order to give the masses a series of images in which they can see themselves and identify themselves. Benjamin, of course, thinks the crowd doesn't have a face, so he's much more interested in interrupting that possibility. So just to let's say, very quickly go toward a moment that I want to talk about to close these remarks. This is one of many moments that one could hone in on, but it's the very famous moment when in the work of art essay he talks about the erratic character of the work of art, which is associated culturally within the history of art at the moment that he's talking about by the German nation as something that signals the authenticity and here and now of the work of art, and therefore the German nation. And what I've always loved about this passage is that if you look at the passage, which describes a series of mountains, a valley, breathing fresh air, and all of this is what the experience of Aura is, it's a citation from Benjamin's 1931 essay, A Short History of Photography, in which, again, he's talking about a strange weave of time and space, and you get this, the valley, the mountains, the breath of fresh air. This passage is itself a displaced citation of the end of Proust's In Search of Lost Time, where, again, you get a valley, a mountain, breathing fresh air, and it's fresh air because it's air that has been breathed before, and the true paradises are the lost paradises. And I want to just say this very telegraphically. What's interesting to me is that at the very moment, again, when one is reading a passage that is supposed to be the passage that tells you about the singularity and originality and the here and now authenticity of a work of art, it's already a reproduction. It's already a citation, right? Which then accounts for why at the beginning of the next thesis he can say the uniqueness of a work of art lies in its being embedded in tradition. So what he's staging here, and I think one of the things that each of these examples are doing, is that they're enacting and performing within the movement of their language what they want to convey. Right? He's giving you an example of what he wants to do. Right? He knows his language isn't just his. He knows if anything singular is going to emerge, it has to pass through what he's inherited. Right? And his only hope, he thinks, is to take the language he inherits, recontextualize it, and move it in another direction in the hope that he can inaugurate a future that won't simply be the repetition of the past. And I think in each one of these instances, I think that what I'm suggesting is that each of these writers, at a particular moment, come to believe that if there's going to be an adjustment, if there's going to be a transformation, it has to take place at the level of the appropriation and remobilization of the language that one inherits. You can see this now even in, and I'll close with this, in the Occupy Wall Street movement, right? Which is gaining strength precisely because of its slogans and its mobilization of its slogans, which are slogans that engage a language that they inherit and try to move it elsewhere, right? We're the 99%. Land of the free, home of the brave. there would be other ones too. I lost my job. I found an occupation. Right? I mean, each time we're too big to fail. Right, the 99%. So they're taking the language that is circulating, recontextualizing, and trying to move it somewhere else. And I think in each one of these instances, that's what I'm suggesting is at stake. And I think that. For me, the stakes of adjustment, the stakes of transformation, have everything to do with taking this risk, because it is a risk. The moment you start engaging the language you inherit, you always run the risk, because that language isn't just yours, of reinforcing the very thing you want to go against. Okay. Thank you for your patience.
Hi, my name is Mimi Chang. I recently graduated from the Maryland Institute College of Art, and I'm now a fellow at SLOT, and so I'm slightly nervous but very grateful to be here with all of you. And so I guess I wanted to start with saying that I, in terms of my own practice, I'm still trying to first truly understand the context in which my work will be in. So just really, as Annie, you said, sort of visualizing the power structures that are already in place in order to work off of them. And I also wanted to sort of share a situation or perhaps an anecdote that made me think of evasion and resistance. So I went to school in Baltimore, and I was a part of a project called Baltimore Open City, and we received a grant to sort of take over an abandoned storefront. And it wasn't until we received the grant that we found out that the storefront was located inside a very contested area of town called the Superblock, because within that block there were so many historic buildings, one of which is called the Reed Street Drugstore, and it was the site of one of the first sit-ins during the Civil Rights Movement. And so this area of land was going to be redeveloped by an outside developer who wanted to turn it into, you know, very commercial, you know, a strip mall, some condos, parking lots, things like that. And in order for us to receive this money, there was basically a gag order put on us saying that whatever you do within the storefront cannot affect the future of this area. And so it was actually one of the best compliments we could have gotten from the city, because they recognized that we really understood this location, and they sort of saw us as a very, very real threat. And so I don't think we were truly able to take as full advantage as we could of this situation. But there was this really great analogy in the book. I think it was Emerson who said, in order to resist, you really have to, you know, like push off of the shore in order to go forward. And in order to jump, you have to, you know, place your feet on the ground and use that force. And so we were really given this wonderful force to sort of go off of. And I think the conclusion that we came to was, at that particular moment in time, the most effective thing we could do was to really just make visible some of the politics that were going on in the area through a, like a parallel means rather than a very direct confrontational means. So, yeah, that's it.
We're really going in literal military order in here. Can we escape that? Thank you, Aaron, for inviting me. And oh, Eva, Frank, Gilabert. The question, just so that I can rephrase it, is like evasion. We started with that, right?
Or adjustment.
Adjustment. And we were just, in a certain way, talking about how adjustment always needs of a ground, of a close reading, or perhaps a distracted reading. I like to think of adjustment in two ways, adjustment as an ideology or adjustment as a strategy, meaning there is always this position of being in the edge of that society that has been constructed to you in the one you are constantly positioning yourself in relation to. And that position of the edge can be the one that is actually looking into its center, or can be looking into a certain periphery, searching for these moments of otherness or of revolution or outsideness. How does actually one move? How does one actually evade its own center of reference? I think those are the strategies that one needs to try to investigate. If we, of course, already acknowledge that only these languages, only the tools that we are given are the ones that we have in order to be able to perpetrate this escape, then how are we going to find out our individual path towards this moment of otherness? And the idea of eroticism, or the idea of perhaps of desire, of the idea of gut, that is always what I think is the most disregarded aspect when we actually talk about power, is when we actually are able to bring that what we carry that exists in the lines in between of all those inherited blocks, meaning even if we need to be extremely conscious and be able to make close readings of the languages and the structures that we are given, the most seminal task is actually to find the interstices, to mean to be able to acquire a kind of floating attention where we are not anymore so close to the object of refusal, of resistance, of this ground that we are supporting ourselves in order to be able to know where we want to jump. I mean, talking about Wall Street, I mean, it was 4 a.m. and I was there yesterday night. And the interesting thing is that one doesn't know anymore what is the ground. There is just an ideological position towards what evasion is. And that, I think, is something that is extremely problematic about the circumstance that we have right now. It was 5 p.m. and I was talking with architectural representatives of the Occupy Wall Street movement that are trying to perpetuate the demonstrator as a figure that just simply stays there in a moment of stasis, obviously without having a project, without having a destination, because that's part of what resistance is about, is not having a project, is just having this, what we were talking, this moment of floating, waiting until the revolution, perhaps then maybe something happens, right? And then that political moment eventually might happen. But there is a certain ideological position of evasiveness that I don't think is strategic enough. And maybe, Aaron, you know that I have been working in these last months with a kind of a call of ideas for strategies for urban occupation that are not necessarily trying to give moments or destinations of, but they are just paths to evade those rules that are given. And it is simply just being able to acknowledge the structures of power in terms of law, in terms of communication, in terms of language, and try to find those gaps, those voids that one might find what we call little loopholes. And, of course, I mean, the first time you gave me this book, right, I was like, evasions of power. And I'm like, how is it possible? I mean, it's the power of evasion, right? And it just was really shocking to me because there is no such a thing as the evasions of power. It's impossible. It's an oxymoron, right? And the whole project here, or the one that I have no idea why I'm sitting here today, from which voice of authority somehow, but the idea is that I'm really interested in the power of evasion and in this possibility of always trying to move into a space that is still yet not here. Not necessarily that I know in which kind of ideological grounds that the space exists, but it's the only way to actually move and escape. And I think the project in itself is just to be able to move into the next ground. And so I didn't prepare anything, so I have no idea if I probably things might come in a kind of like ordered way. But just talking about notions of evasion, and I always like to bring some examples. What there are two ways of resistance, and I like to actually perhaps use more like the little French word if you want. But is you have the one of little Bartleby, right? I would rather not do it, right? And is. Yes. How do you?
Bartleby.
What did they say?
Bartleby.
Yeah. I rather would not, right? I prefer not to. I have no idea how to translate that into English. So that's a strategy of evasion, if one wants. But then we have the one of, like, Hitchcock, when he actually uses, like, the MacGuffin effect, right? When he actually is, he knows so well how someone is actually watching a film, that he's able to place this object that is going to work as an object of attention and desire, that is going to make you, that is going to distract you, is going to take you away from actually the scene of the object that is actually the scene of the crime, or the real scene that is actually happening in the background, so that he's actually able to produce a process of surprise, and he's actually going to make this moment at the end, and you will want to go again and to rediscover it again. So the task of trying to be able to find within our own mediums those MacGuffin effects, those moments that we are able to teach to the audience, to teach to our interlocutors, to teach into our partners, abilities to actually just want to live that moment again and to realize that we have been trapped, that in every single act of looking, of being and acting, there is something that we're not conscious enough that someone already knows. And this is this moment of death or life, right? You are only conscious of your own presence, the moment that you know that you're not being simply just script from every single word that you are saying. And so, I don't know. I think I would, now in this kind of roulette of words, I will pass it to my right, apparently.
I started it, so.
Maybe I can just to add, as you mentioned, Hitchcock, and then the issue that I was interested is the issue of aesthetics. If one speaks of power of evasion or the adjustment, I just wanted to explain the image, which is on the website. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know it, seen it. Just to tell, in fact, this is a building in Bosnia, that a city which was shelled, and now it is under reconstruction. So this one person refuses to be pig, be peach, and he purchases a big satellite dish and leaves the bullet marks. But what is fascinating is the line, the division line that the city makes, which perfectly is this perfect line which makes it into something, say, the straightest thing this country has ever done in that sense. So I'm really curious about just to go on the image, because we brought in the image on the, and the object of desire, the image of desire, the possibility of desire, and the sort of the aesthetics, the skills, in fact, which come with it as such. So just to give you that context, mm-hmm. of the spectrum.
Just a small addition to all what I've heard is again going back to the personal level and the kind of like everyday practice, what we try or try not to do is actually the difference between language and life. And I don't know how you feel about this, but more and more feel like that I have to choose. I either gonna speak or live my life, or other people, other people's lives.
You can only
listen. Or I can either shut up and live without words, or else I have to come up with a totally different language, a non-existing language. And hopefully that non-existing language gonna equal with my life. And that's, It seems to be an utterly imposing task, and I think everybody is facing with this. I mean, each and every human beings are is facing with this, and we kind of get lost in this process. We are in between the illusion. We actually still trying to embrace the illusion of being able to speak and live in the same time. Yet, our lives and our experience are constantly proving that it cannot exist this way anymore. So, to me, this is one of the most intriguing phenomenon. How to be honest, actually. How to recognize the void, what I constantly feel. How to live around that void, or kind of like, I just can't find the proper phrase for this, but how to inhabit that void.
There is something, I mean, I cannot agree probably at all with what you just said, mm-hmm. because you're presupposing that we can exist without that language, that we can exist without those things that we are given. And I'm not sure that that's possible. I mean, we are through this language, through these structures, through our positioning in relationship to those things, in a certain way, as if we would be invisible and we only become ourselves by entering in contact with all those things that are given by society, by the past, by history. And to try to think that there is a void or a pre-existing self that needs to be discovered, I mean, obviously, it's a totally like philosophical position or a position of pre-existing, or I mean, it's one would go like Chomsky against Foucault, right? Human nature versus resistance. But I don't think, I mean, mostly because we constantly ask, probably all of us, those questions. I don't think there is such a thing as that void. There is maybe a force. There are some forces that move those things around, and that one only can find oneself in relationship to that society. If we would have been born in a void, maybe we could do that. But we haven't. So, maybe, I mean, I think this is a very interesting.
Go on, and I just want to say I absolutely agree with Eva. I think that we're born into language. The moment you're given a last name, you're already inscribed into a network of relations that pre-exist you. What I would say is that it's not a choice between life and language. It's a question of what kind of life one has, given that one is already in advance inscribed within a network of languages. And what I would say is that, among other things, what that means is that one never simply lives, but one is always living and dying at the same time, precisely because that engagement or involvement with language is something both enables us to articulate a sense of who we are, at the same time that it takes away the chance of our being able to express our identity as singular, etc. And I always think about it in relation to something like the following paradox, which is linked to what Eva said, is that we are who we are because of our relations to others and our inscription within this entire unforeseeably mediated set of relations. And at the same time, it's precisely because of these relations that we're never simply just ourselves. And so that unless one says, I am the one who is never simply just myself, and which one can say, I think. So that I think that the desire to escape, evade language, is a desire that is articulated within language. You can't articulate that desire outside of language. What I would say then is that at some level we're entirely unprovided for in relation to that evasion and escape. Which is why, among other things, and this I would agree with you, that there, one doesn't know how to proceed. One always proceeds in the dark in some way. One has to proceed in the dark. You cannot know in advance what the consequences of this or that act will be, because that's one of the risks of action. It unfolds in time with unforeseeable consequences, which is why I think Marx very famously wrote to Beazley and said, anyone who has a program for the future is a reactionary. You can't program the future. You can't program the change. You can only, on the basis of what you think you should do, that it's better to do this than that, because you think that if you do this, you will reap this benefit rather than that disaster. But that one never knows in advance. And I think that's the risk of reform and the risk of transformation, which is the danger, right? That's the danger. You're inscribed in a language that isn't just yours. So anytime you speak and act and think with that language, you run the risk of doing something that you presumably don't wish to do.
But Jakob, you were trying to say something different. You weren't necessarily saying that you were simply trying to evade language. You're trying to say that we live not just in peculiar or precarious times, but in a time which feels kind of like a prison, in which everything has become private, and everything has become precarious and ephemeral, and it's not clear how one holds on to the power of evasion. Is that what I heard you saying?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that we should eliminate, and we can eliminate, I mean, that would be utterly ridiculous, language itself. But I do feel like, and I do believe that we are losing language in any sort, I mean, in any form right now. So we have to come up with our own languages. So we are in a process to identify, to find a new language, and this is a personal task, and that's a daily everyday practice what we are doing. I was just trying to talk about my constant disillusionment in languages. So I, and on a practical basis, I don't know how to say what I think. Mm-hmm. I just don't know how to phrase it. Everything around me, everything what comes to languages, seems to be utterly contaminated. So how on earth I can phrase it? How far I can go back to be able to say exactly what I don't feel, what I live. So how you can phrase the existence in any minute. So is it utterly romantic illusion to find a proper language in the midst of this ridiculous political correctiveness? So that's what I'm trying to.
There's a maybe I just want to add on this. If I'm done, I'm sorry. This impossibility that you mention is the impossibility of existence, right? I mean, if I pick on what you said, Eduardo, is, I mean, if we are already living, if we are the other, as Arto says, and if we are trying to exist in somebody else's language, this means that we are also adjusting as others, as somebody else's values. So the people who are in Occupy Wall Street, they are others, they are subscribing to somebody else's values. So there's no singularity or identity in that respect, if you are in the language. But that's the impossibility, because we are also singular in identifying things. And I want to respond to the precarious times issue. Like, are we really living in a very different moment today than 100 years ago in terms of this impossibility? I mean, you can see people, you can read people who are in the midst of their language crisis or, you know, existential crisis, because the language was always impossible. But now, maybe because of the mediation of that impossibility, now we are lining up, forming different kind of affiliations or kinships around this impossibility. So we are reacting towards this impossibility, which is a revolutionary, reactionary thing towards your own existence. Yes, we are always impossible. We were always living in this impossibility, and we are surviving here. So this adjustment and evasion of that adjust,
adjustment is the drive to exist and try to exist with others and against to in relationship to other powers.
I guess I wanted to shift the temporal scales, since Orkun, you had in the very beginning invited us to think with a different temporal logic in mind. And it seems narcissistic on some level to always imagine that, like, the power of one's evasion will be immediately legible in the moment you live. It will play out right in front of your eyes in the societal transformation that you've invested your hope for the future on. And so I know this will come as no surprise to most of you, but I actually think it's important to go back to other models. And like for me, like an extraordinary evasion or extraordinary adjustment would be found, again, in Kant's essay on perpetual peace, which actually does not, Eduardo, I don't know if you'd agree with this, it doesn't find its readership in its moment. It doesn't find it in his lifetime. It actually, it's recuperated or it's recovered after the fact. And the power of that evasion or adjustment, however we want to terminologically call it, is something that plays out long after the time in which one lives. And it's completely, to a certain degree, perhaps accidental as to whether it gets recovered or not. But it seems that it's interesting to think of an extraordinary adjustment as not something that you ever witness. I was asked recently, and Mimi and Megan know this because they helped me write it, to submit a minority report for the future to a group in Chicago. And it was very difficult to like write this minority report on the city of Philadelphia and its future. And so I wrote this minority report with regard to the present in Philadelphia, with regard to the crises the city faces. And then they kept coming back wanting me to be more specific about the future. And so I quoted them Eduardo's citation of Marx. I marshaled everything I could to explain to them why I couldn't author myself.
Did they get it?
Their future. Or the future of this city that actually has been marked by a very problematic series of definitions over the years concerning what its future should be. And I explained that it's not my decision to make, and it's, let alone is it within our, let's say, framework or methodology to presume that even a multitude of voices could author it. And of course this made no sense to them.
But it might make sense to someone 2 centuries from now.
But I also, I agree that there are these kind of, there's a long view, you know, the historical perspective, but there's also, I think, a sort of privilege in not sort of acknowledging the sort of very real and very pressing needs that people face in everyday moments, and that there is an importance in sort of not being paralyzed in the sort of inability to act or to have agency, but there is a necessity in acting in the present moment and proceeding. And I think a lot about, I'm working with a group of queer youth of color right now that are, have identified the West Village as a safe space for decades. And because of the privatization of the sort of West Side, are no longer welcome there, who are being policed, who are being, discriminated against on many levels. And so, you know, they don't have the luxury of the historical perspective in this moment. They have to find a means to act. And so how do we also, acknowledge that at the same moment? And what are the tactics and strategies for, for those who can't afford to wait for the historical perspective to act effectively. So I think, for them that the evasion is very real. The evasion is a necessary strategy for existing in this space. So one thing we've been thinking about is how do we create this How do we sort of create strategies for them to kind of advocate for their presence there and to map their identity and presence onto the space? And so that's just something that, is, I think, it's going to be unique in the context, but I just want to bring it back in.
if I can say something about, because I actually am very grateful for that comment, and I'll come at it from a number of different threads. But the first is that no one, I think, would ever say that Marx is not political, right? I mean, he's like Mr. Politics, right? So one of his constant anxieties in every single preface that he wrote to Capital is that people will rush to the streets to try and change things before they read his book. So he has this anxiety that implies that he thinks it's very important to read his book, because at some level he thinks that his book is there to help change the way in which people think and to change their relation to thought, to language, etc. And he thinks that nothing will change with any endurance and permanence unless one can change the way in which people think. And so I think that you're absolutely correct that there is an urgency. Right. But I think what that means for me is that it reminds me that there are many ways and many fronts on which one can address that urgency. Right? One is by being as direct and immediate as possible. But also another thing is, how does one address a contemporary political situation or a contemporary situation in general? Because that situation didn't fall from the sky. It wasn't born in the desert. It has a history that led to it. And so I think that when I'm saying that one has to read historically, I'm saying that reading historically has something to do with how one engages and confronts the present, because that present just didn't appear. It has a history. And unless one can address the present as well as the history that led to it, then I think we are at a loss, which is why the issues continue, right? And I think that unless one understands the history, or at least one's relation to the history that has led to this, then one is more susceptible to reiterating strategies and proposals that could, in the long run, whether they seem to be going in another direction, could reinforce the very thing we want. And that for me is always the danger, but also the fear, right? Yes. Is that the inevitability of complicity in regard to what one wants to do. And I think that is, I mean, Emerson at one point in his essay Fate says, "'Tis fine to say we elect our course as long as we acknowledge an irresistible dictation." Yeah. Which goes back to the, you know, wanting this personal, more private. I just don't believe that it's ever simply personal or private. Mm-hmm. I think the problem is that it's never simply private. It's all, you've already been invaded in some way. So I think that I absolutely am with you in terms of the urgency and need of addressing things on the spot. You know, I mean, why people can go to Wall Street and give clothing, or what. There's a need that is there that has to be addressed. But the things that are being addressed are much larger than that singular instance. I'll just close with one of my favorite quotes from Gramsci's Prison Notebooks, where he says, "The crisis lies precisely in the fact that the old is dying and the new cannot be born. And in that interregnum, a variety of morbid symptoms appear." Right? And so what he says is necessary is to try and think about why, at this particular moment, at this critical moment, why something breaks in this direction rather than that one.
I'm really glad you brought up the issue of space. I mean, you mentioned the word space a few times as a sort of solidifier of adjustment or evasion. And maybe we just kind of, and also you mentioned the word spot, like the spot which could be read in different ways, but the spot which already exists and the one which is being created. So there is a form of what you do, mm-hmm. and that is what I'm really interested in. I would just kind of maybe ask a question further of this relationship of between adjustment or extraordinary adjustment and the so-called space, which can then take over that energy and kind of be reversible. So on one of our interviewees, which we were kind of a bit stunned, Leibowitz Woods, was very critical of adjustment, and he said the revolution, and architecture has to be part of that revolution to kind of solidify it. Mm-hmm. And he criticized Occupy Wall Street because it doesn't do that. It doesn't have those spatial, how do you call it, like freezers, refrigerators. And I think if it is a paradox, we can leave it as a paradox, but I would think somehow it emerging in my thinking that there is more connection between adjustment and construction than between revolution and construction in very many sense. Because the revolution usually occupies existing structures and leaves them. But that's just an uncrafted thought.
I mean, I see that you constantly bring the space back into the conversation, into a place where, even to me, I was like, wow, how do we land? How are you, like, piercing us down? And the whole fact of trying to really literally translate all these temporalities, all these projections into real actions is always in this leap of faith towards a failure that we know that we are facing in every single act. And even if the architect is that one that wants to acknowledge that there is an a priori understanding of the consequences, there is only the possibility of real evasiveness if one doesn't really know what is actually going to happen, because the moment that the plan already contains that moment of resolution, it is already ideologically constrained, and then we are done. But this has a lot to do, actually. I have been totally obsessed throughout my short, long career, I don't know. I have no idea, talking about time, on the idea of utopia and how utopia is a word that we cannot use it anymore, right? We try to go away from it because of its burden and because of its inability to actually keep us fueling towards a space that is desirable because of its ideological burdens. But I have always taken utopia as a space of doubt, a space of questioning the status quo. And the time of utopia, and that goes back to what Aaron was actually asking, is that it's always either this future anterior, right? That is never a future, it's just like a future yet to come, and I believe that's Jameson who actually frames it that way. And the past is never a past, is a present anterior in that regard, because we can only look from the place where we stand, right? And I've always been extremely interested. I write fictions constantly, fictions about the present, fictions about the future, fictions about the past. And they are all simply retroactive utopias, right? They are only able to construct a future in relationship to a past that I carry. And I think, and then you can actually put dates, and it's very interesting, and then you can put numbers, and we don't know how long this hour is going to be and if this is going to be the eternity of our days, but is the virtue of the time and the non-measure of ideas. And I think that's the capital that we have. And I don't... If the ideas that we are writing now are going to be valid in 200 years or in 2 hours, I think that's something that we can... I don't think that our thoughts carry the burden of time. And I think while we always live in a time of urgency, we are totally like just living in this moment of presentness in relationship to the past and in relationship to the future. And I couldn't put it through such a nice quotation, and that was like simply... That was extremely astonishing, but is this timelessness of the need of actually express this action, and when we do it through a space, I mean, like just really looking into Occupy Wall Street, and I have been obsessively going every day, trying to sort, just really trying to learn. Right? It's like as much as I refuse that I'm not going to find anything that is, I go and I look and I listen, and. And there was this moment when actually Zizek showed up and he was like, we have the right to think differently. Right? That this is simply stated as something that needs to be stated. For me, that was like the scary thing of the recognizing of the moment. That we are allowed to think otherwise, that we are allowed to build otherwise, that's not the status quo, that's not the condition of life. Right? That the condition of life is that we should constantly be taught to think differently.
And what does it mean to think otherwise?
It means that knowing that everything that you're being inherited, right, is not for you to adopt it, it's for you to transform it. If each one of us is here to contribute in some way to this universe that we belong to, is simply by being able to change and to make an adjustment, right, to that what we have been inherited. We are not able to engage in terms of judgment of good or bad. That is not for us to judge, right? But it's just to be able to contribute through our own very personal understandings that what is that we can see through that what is given. It's like, what kind of readings can we extrapolate? What kind of, like, passages, excursions, diversions can we construct through that? And I think that's the most difficult thing to engage in, a kind of pedagogical project, and it's the only pedagogical project that is the one to actually teach, show how to constantly depart from that what is given, but first, of course, to give it, right? Sometimes the problem of a certain strategies that people just establish resistance or evasion without actually having the knowledge of that what is actually being given to them. And then to try to just simply exercise it. I mean, from my institutional point of view, I represent an institution that its ideological center is the edge, right? And how do you keep yourself moving into an edge? Well, it's, you have to keep on constantly changing programmatically, ideologically, in terms of audiences. You need to reinvent yourself through formats more than through contents. And in terms of a space, I mean, I actually think architecture is probably the most powerful of all tools, because, and this, just the sound, right? Like, how annoying has that been? Probably, like, the only thing that has been annoying while we were talking here was the noise of this, the noise of these seats, right? The way we are sitting, all those things that might make us feel in a certain way, those goosebumps, those moment of, that eventually just happens with some poetry, with some music. It's architecture just does it without you really, truly even wanting it. You don't even have to read it. It just happens to happen to you. And I think that's like the huge power that architecture has because of its proximity to the subject, to really to alter the subject in that regard. And I wish architects would be more conscious of that, but I don't think we don't even have the tools, right? We don't even know enough how that even works.
Then the question is, can... if power is so high and, say, the consciousness is not that high or it is being suppressed, could some forces, like forces of neglect, could be used, in fact, to neglect it, to delay it? I always think of, you know, like politicians who are always charged with commissioning, you know, grand schemes, and when they do, they basically get deposed soon after. And the person who never commissioned anything is Fidel Castro, who basically stays there for like...
He commissioned the schools of art.
He did commission schools of art. But I mean...
Not just that. It's like in 62 there were like hundreds of projects, but yeah.
I mean, but architecture always has the problem of the client, right? I mean, which is why it may be in some ways kind of the least radical, because... this sense of like who's commissioning it and for who, and I worked as an architect for several years before I got fed up, and that was always the challenge, is how do you actually confront power structures when you're working for them, right? So I think these strategies where we kind of intervene outside of the commission, outside of the agency that's commissioning the work, is where kind of this interesting relationship can happen, and where the spaces are appropriated and used and reinvented. But in the actual commission of architecture, I don't know. Does someone disagree with me? But
I just want to say, I don't think we can do revolution from the outside. Meaning, if one is an architect, one needs to be able to engage with the client, with the president, with the politician, and it is the role of the architect to be able to take all those forces of ideological desire and still be able to find the spaces of escape where that project of otherness is still possible, if it is a good architect. But that's the ultimate project, right? You are able to bring all those things and say yes, yes, yes. You want it white? Sure. You want it a square? Sure. Everyone has... there are still so many other things to be able to transform and to change them. And that's where the power of imagination and the power of creativity resides. That isn't to be able to articulate those desires that society has, because society just can ask you for that what they know. No one will ask you for something that they don't know. And it's only the architect that can actually bring that what is still not known yet, it will become known, then we will become ideological, then we need to move on, right? But I don't surrender. I have hope for the architects.
I want to strike a different tenor, though, again, because I think there's like suddenly this extraordinary agency that the architect has that it just merely has to figure out a way to share with others. This was Levius's, the import of Levius's rather formalist position, right? Architects have this responsibility to design a new constructed environment.
No, that the revolution begins with architecture.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
his claim.
Yeah. And I guess... I mean, sometimes when you work on a project like this project that we've all been part of one way or the other, you actually never have a chance to read because you're working on the project so that others can read. But so yesterday, somehow there was time to read. I felt like before Tuesday arrives, I better figure out a way to have read even a few pages. And so I started to read Samuel Weber's essay again. Or for the first time, it felt like. And he was talking about something differently. He was talking about this desire that you spoke of to occupy an edge condition. I think we would all identify with that aspiration. But what I heard Samuel Weber suggesting was that you occupy an edge condition not by constructing a border between what you're afraid of and fearful of and what you want to hold on to, but rather you occupy an edge condition by being perpetually, excuse me, contaminated by other ways of thinking and by being so open that you become a multitude, a plurality of ideas and positions that is changing in time. And as you said, doesn't reach the finality, or as you said, Eduardo, as well, like never reaches a finality of the confidence of a single gesture. And so it seems to me that today to occupy an edge condition or to be an architect would be to be so responsive and so open as to almost be lost in that process of perpetual contamination rather than of perpetual fear. And so I would be interested, like hearing from architects in the room, what would it mean to, what would an architecture of contamination or an architecture of openness take the spatial form of? It would be, I guess, an architecture of hospitality, of radical openness.
I think the trick is that already all those words, like there is a hospitality design, which is already a corporate sort of direction, which is a different word for hotels and things like that. So in a way, anything you take as a seemingly positive attribute, it is already being co-opted and put into practice. So in a way...
So be it, but that doesn't mean that the responsibility to be hospitable to the welfare and dignity of others
absolutely
is
agree.
Not the,
absolutely
the
agree.
Fundamental issue.
But then the strategy to inhabit it and to say yes, 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 is the only one that can actually adjust it to some direction. I mean, on the other hand of the spectrum, if one, like you, you know, like, I want to be an ex-architect, too. I'm looking for an exit strategy. So, but anyways, so the suspension of practice or the neglect can be seen as strategic decision and let things vanish, in fact. To kind of melt through some different process could be one of the possibilities to think about much wider than you know cutting things in stone and sort of rearranging desires for permanent spacing.
Well, maybe just to, I mean, I will not respond as an architect, but I would just say, I mean, architecture is not only about the building process, right? It's a form of organizing knowledge. It's a discourse. It's a rhetoric. So. I mean, architects contribute to the society in many different ways. Through, you know, you transform your client. You just not only build a building, but you also change, produce, initiate change on the social level. You publish. You contribute on many different levels. So, I would say, like language, like literature. I mean, every field has a different responsibility to transform and a different capacity to transform. At the end, maybe architecture is a good way, a good strategy, because it can resist being reactionary, because it is, you know, at the end,
it is a slow process. It's not. It doesn't necessarily need to bring clothes to the people on the street. Maybe do that, but it can transform you so that you go and bring these clothes over there. So it is a different level of agency to manipulate things in the broader context.
I also think that in a way, architectural practice needs to, in the way that you're discussing, it needs to broaden itself, it needs to transform itself, because if we are limited by, the confines of the project brief that we're handed, then often, our hands are tied, I think, to create, to respond in a meaningful way. And one example I'll give is, so we've been doing this work around the East River waterfront, adjacent to Chinatown in the Lower East Side, and are part of a coalition that formed of public housing advocates, tenant associations, a very broad array of local stakeholders who came together because the shop proposal for the waterfront was not acceptable. Did not serve their community's needs. And a big component of that was the creation of a for-profit, pay-to-play basketball facility, very similar to Chelsea Piers, right? And so this, this was part of the brief that shop was handed, right? They were handed, this was on the table. It's a huge swath of this waterfront, adjacent, by the way, next to the largest public housing campuses in New York City. So there's this given, right, that they have nothing to do. So for us, it's more meaningful to engage around the structures, right, to figure out how do we insert an alternative. And I think that architects have to be willing to engage with not just the client, but with those who stand to be affected by what they create in a different way, and by being passive in that process, they're reinforcing these existing power structures, in this case the EDC. But
to be contaminated by other ways of thinking is not to be passive. Just as to not want to invoke this clear sense of the future is not to not be concerned with the welfare of others in the present.
I would say that the very fact that we're here discussing these issues in relation to this project, Evasions of Power, is a confirmation of something that is linked to your question, but I would formulate just more simply in a certain way, that what makes architecture is that it's never simply itself. So that it's never just about buildings, it's never just about space, it's always about language, discourses, citations. Buildings are totally citational, which is why, they can be replicated in different forms, and structures can be replicated. So that I think that I would say the same thing about literature. I'm in an English department, but I'm an associate member of the School of Architecture. That already means that the architecture department that has welcomed me doesn't think of itself as only about buildings.
So what would be an example of something that would not apply to? That formulation.
Architecture
or literature is not only about itself. What would be an example of something where that does not...
I think there's no example that wouldn't follow that structure.
Even
I think
power.
There's no such thing. Yeah. There's never a single thing, that would be self-identical to itself. That's my axiom.
And power would be another example.
That would be another one.
That always is metastasizing in different ways.
That it what?
Is metastasizing or manifesting.
Yeah,
itself.
But people wanted. Even the interview that was online, right? Uh-huh. Where he says revolution begins in architecture. It's a very formalistic conception of architecture.
Yeah.
In terms of agency, in terms of subjects,
in sort of its
singularity. Uh-huh. In relation to other disciplines or other fields, I think that's ideological mystification.
There is a very clear trick, actually, that we have been playing ourselves in relationship to that is disciplines as distinctions, right? And we have identified ourselves as, I'm an architect, I'm not, and I would say, I'm a citizen, right? And as such, I exercise through something that sometimes can be called architecture, and you know it well, sometimes it's called cooking, yet I still call it architecture. Sometimes it's called walking, and I still call it architecture. And sometimes I call it whatever, right? And the idea is this distinction of disciplines and expertise is a structure of control so that we are able to exercise, given the books of that what it is and that what shouldn't, what we should be doing in some ways, and where should we limit our constraints of reaction, of erasure, of tension. And I think architecture has always wanted to think itself as a discipline that unable to find its autonomy, as much as some of them were really insisting in trying to find it. I think its essence, its inability actually to really truly find it. And that's the whole idea of it. There is a kind of a humanist figure practicing nowadays that has that full responsibility more publicly than others, is the role of the architect, where all these different forces have to come together. And when you ask the question of what would be a spatial translation of an architecture that is in the edge, right? It's like your question is totally loaded, right? Mm-hmm. Who told you that it needs to have a spatial translation, right? It's a really like Gideon understanding that it's a spatial translation, the one that actually constitutes an architecture, like the essence of architecture. And I think those are questions. It's like, that's the same kind of question. If you say, what kind of rhythm is a poem going to have to be a truly contemporary poem, right? And it's like, are you talking about like a sonnet or like an octave? It's like just the question itself has so many traps. So, and I think that's the whole thing. Where architecture finds its moment of otherness, it's always something that for me is a mystery. And talking about how many different types, I actually really like to put people within typologies. I like to put things inside cases so I can actually start to escape them. And I like to categorize architects in three types. The ideologist, right? Then we actually have the enablers, and then we have the agitators, right? And the three of them, they are quite terrible, right? Because like the ideologist, he's like the one who, in a certain way, is like the one that follows like certain principles, or he's like the iconographer that tries to represent the values of society, and he thinks he embodies everything, and then we get some Calatravas, let's say. Then we actually have the enabler, that is the one that says yes to everything, right? And of course, only to say yes to everything, that's actually problematic, because in a certain way you just absorb that what is there without being able to contribute anything new. And then you have the little agitator, that is the one that is in a certain way like the Oedipal reaction to like the parents of ideology and enabler, and he's like just reacting against everything at all without actually able to propose anything. And that's where I always say that we need a fourth character, we need a fourth architect. That is the utopianizer, that is the guy who actually comes and is able to look into the values of all those different things and to propose this space of otherness. Sometimes it's a space, sometimes it's color, sometimes it's noise, sometimes it's words. But it is a position, and I don't think it takes a form. And I think Lebeau's at some point, he was one of those figures in some precise moments, but he constituted an ideology of his own work. That he thinks that it contains that kind of revolution through a formal exercise that I don't think it is there anymore. But
Lebeau was quite clear that that he understood that today a radical transformation would take other forms, mm-hmm. and that it might actually take the form of an adjustment or an extraordinary adjustment. And
wait. Say that sentence again?
What was interesting about the conversation with Lebeau was that at one and the same time that he insisted on the importance not of adjustment but of radical transformation, mm-hmm. he also understood that this was a very generationally specific modality of thought. And
I think we have always been thinking the same way. We mm-hmm. are always revolutionary. Mm-hmm. We're always at the end of times. Mm-hmm.
But he seemed to acknowledge that today one would not announce that your project is a radical transformation. You might mm-hmm. strategically actually call it an adjustment. And he seemed to be quite clear in understanding that his terminology may no longer be an effective mm-hmm. terminology for one's project, whatever that project may be. Yeah. But anyway, I wanted to defend the use of the spatial. We had been engaged in a dialogue, mm-hmm. and in that dialogue, Sir John and others had been insisting on thinking spatially. And so it was out of hospitality to that conversation that I was thinking of architecture in relation to the spatial. But Annie, I was wondering if I could... I still want Orkan to speak more, if Orkan is interested in speaking more, about the temporal, which is how we opened. Because, and I know I've already like kind of insisted on this, but in speaking and in thinking, not with architects or with artists, but with diplomats and others, they have a very different... can you just move that microphone away? They have a very different temporal register, right? They think on the level of decades. They think on the level of centuries. Whereas we think, again, on the level of the year we live in. And Annie, I was wondering if you, or kind of both of you could speak to this, because, I mean, Annie, you're engaged very intimately in supporting the rights of neighborhoods and the rights of residents in particular localities in the moment. At the same time, I'm interested in how one negotiates that very intimate involvement with the other way that, from a social service perspective, that you think, which is you work on the level of decades and of generations, and you are supporting very intimately and very sustainably, let's say, over the long haul, the rights of neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. It's very different than the way cultural organizations work. It's like it's a one-time kind of engagement with a topic. Perhaps a year later you come back. Perhaps there's a constellation of thinking. But in the cultural sector, one has a rather passive, I would say, I don't know if you agree with this, Eva, but like a fairly momentary and fleeting encounter with a topic or responsibility to that topic. So I don't know if either of you want to pick this up, but these other temporalities by which, again, as Orkan had begun, to think about adjustment and evasion.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is like this kind of immediate, short-term kind of scale to the work in terms of addressing these kind of needs on the ground. But then there is the longer, you know, what is the larger systemic, you know, change you're trying to create. And so I think that they actually work really well together. That approach of thinking both in this like hyper-localized kind of situational projects, but then also in terms of the larger project that they are a part of. And I think actually they inform each other in really interesting ways. And I think it's only by doing repetitive projects on the ground in park sites, in the Lower East Side in Chinatown, with immigrants, youth, the whole array of stakeholders, that you start to see different methodologies emerge or different tactics for engaging with the Parks Department, for example. my favorite agency in New York City. But so then I think that if you were to do that in a one-off kind of manner, you would never be able to sort of, you know, think about this larger scale and this longer project. And so for me, that relationship between the individual project, the local, super contextual, and then the meta context is really interesting, and they're always informing each other. And I think, for me, I wouldn't want to give up either approach, because I think that they work hand in hand. And yeah.
You know, I just want to make a remark about why I wanted to caution us about the time scale, because my worry is that we should not be moralizing adjustment, because today's rights cannot be tomorrow's rights, and from whose standpoint are we correcting, are we making a contribution, something. That's, I mean, because my fear, for example, to be reactionary is because I am told to be reactionary. I mean, I'm primed to be reactionary. Everything is mediated. I am receiving messages about how Wall Street is invaded, in the middle of the night, so I react to this, but I cannot take myself out from that thing. I'm forced to be reactionary. So I want to breathe a little bit, and I want to reflect on what is really the need for adjustment, and for whom I am adjusting, and who is benefiting out of this at the end. So just to be cautious about why we're doing, where this is going, and where am I told to follow, whom to follow.
This is really interesting. What you just mentioned, because I think it's a position of being. Like, perhaps I would say that all of us sitting here might live in a constant state of adjustment, mm-hmm. and we adjust to even the first adjustments that are being.
Adjust the sound, right?
Is, like it's totally. No, we discriminate extremely well, right? And the nice thing about discrimination is that one is not that conscious of it, and that's where like the instinctual in a certain way comes in, and in order to know oneself better, if one is the task, is to know about what is that we discriminate, mm-hmm. right? Because we only see that what we know, and we can only hear that we can recognize. And sometimes we are sensible to things that we are still not knowledgeable of or conscious of. But I don't, as much as I receive constant exposure to all those different needs for reaction and for demonstration, and there is always a way for me to translate things back. And yesterday at 5 p.m. when I was meeting with, like in the morning I was with Jeanette Sadikan, like from the DOT, right? Department of Transportation. I went to the federal building or whatever that building is without an ID. Like I thought I could just go, right? Mm-hmm. And they were like, no way. And I'm like, I'm just going to see Jeanette, right? It's like you come to store from you enter into the basement. So it was like this lack of adjustment towards another space. So. And then at 5, I was with a guy who are trying like to actually squat, and there is a plan for squatting the entire city. And as much as they are totally different, even if I would sympathize with them, I always, my task, and perhaps because I'm an antagonistic person or because I think that my task is always to position myself, even if we agree, I will try to disagree just for the sake of conversation. Unless we really, truly agree a lot, right? And that for me is extremely important. And it is this position of constantly living in an adjustment, because that's the only way that one keeps on learning, and I owe it to myself somehow. And so, for me, adjustment is not a task. It's not something that requires an effort. It's our condition of being. Otherwise, then we are dead, right? So,
yeah, I know that Eduardo wants to say something, but actually, I would like to kind of maybe charge it. To go back to Marx, I remember there was actually too bad that Jakob had to go, but there, George Lukács, Hungarian dissident, he not only adjusted the way of understanding but also the way of reading. I think this is what you are talking about, that the reading and misreading, in fact, of two different individuals, kind of. Puts the time ahead for, as you say, adjustment, which would happen anyways. So it is not critical, so to speak. But like, so Lukács had this in his historical novel, right? In fact, which then reads Marx, Capital, not as a treatise, but as a novel, in fact, with characters, with drama, with this. I mean, that's, would you think that is one of the historical extraordinary adjustments on a strategic level that can be used today?
Can you say a little more about the strategy?
The strategy is about deliberate misreading of the genre. So, Lukács misreads. He doesn't read the way he was told to read. He basically reads it in a way he wants to read, dislocating the way of reading. So, say you're given you're given an economical treatise or political text, but you read it as a novel, not as a political text, thus kind of like taking the descent into the personal sphere, but translating it back into the output, which then becomes shared.
Then maybe I can return quickly and telegraphically to one of the examples I gave earlier, Douglass's narrative, because at a certain moment when he's talking about how he gained language and how he learned language, you can see that he's someone who, even before he learns how to read, is entirely literate. I mean, he knows how to read social situations. He knows, for example, that poor white children are hungry. So he's able to get food and come to them and get lessons in exchange for the food. He also knows they're very competitive. So he can go and say, oh, I can write better than you. No, you can't. Yes, you can. No, you can't. Oh, show me. And he says, I got a lot of free lessons that way. So at a certain point, he says, what I learned was that education is incompatible with slavery. Okay. But we know that education is not incompatible with slavery, right? That there are certain education, certain forms of training that actually are totally consonant with slavery. So that what it is, and this, I guess, is getting toward what you're saying, what he does is he puts himself through a counter-education, right? He puts himself through an education that is meant to enable him to question, to challenge, etc. And I think that I like the example of the Lukács because I recently, in fact, it's part of the Evasions piece I did, is Marx's own relation to literature and how literature becomes a resource for him and why, again, the political thinker draws his resources from literature, right? Reads the young Hegelians through Don Quixote, reads the Royalists through Balzac, why he thinks this is important. And I think that it is. I mean, I think that what's at stake, and this is what I always tell my students, is in fact to learn how to read, and to learn how to read historically, right? Which has to do with this double reading that Annie was talking about too, both in terms of the local and the historical, and knowing that the local is never simply local, but already marked by history. I want to return to this idea of the speed or slowness with which one thinks about these things. I think I can give a series of quick anecdotes. One is 3 years ago, I'm the chair of the Edward Said Memorial Lecture Committee at Princeton. We invited Noam Chomsky, and he gave this wonderful talk. At the moment of the discussion, one of the young students gets up and says, okay, I hear what you're saying, but I just don't see any changes anywhere. I don't see any change. I don't have any hope anymore. And what he says, well, I don't know. I disagree with you. What are you talking about? Things have changed a lot in the last 50 years. And which I thought was an amazing thing to say. Because it has everything to do with the speed and desire for immediate change. But to presume that is to presume that what you're dealing with is entirely present right there and then, which it's not, right? It's not. I mean, whatever you're looking at is already a symptom of an entire network of historical forces, right? So that if you really want to engage it and address it, you have to address it, but at the same time address everything that has led to it. And I think that's part of a critical strategy, and it has everything to do with learning how to read historically, which is to say that if you believe, as I do, that you're always using a language that isn't just yours, then you better really have a sense of how deeply enmeshed you are in the very thing that you want to overcome. Because if you're not, it's not that knowing that is an escape or a guarantee that you can overcome it, but at least it's a first step in trying to minimize the chances that you will blindly reinforce and reiterate. That's all you can do is hope to minimize that, I think. I can give one. Okay, two more. Yeah. Where have you been all my life? Okay. Two. One is it's actually an interest that has to do with the complicity issue, and then the other one has to do with what it means to look at something and decide how one acts politically. And the first one is I was in a class, actually it was a class, I don't generally reveal this, it was a class taught by Derrida. We were reading texts by German Jews between the two wars. At a certain point, he says, or asks, what could anti-Semitism be if it were compatible with everything? If the moment you opened your mouth, thought a thought, or spoke a word, you couldn't help but think, speak, or whatever, something that would go in the direction of anti-Semitism. So one of the students in the class referred to a particular Jewish group in Paris that had been trying to work against anti-Semitism. Okay, so he smiles and he says, well, we all know how Jews can sometimes be anti-Semitic. And he gave a history of this particular group and showed how certain things they had done to fight anti-Semitism, had actually encouraged and produced and furthered anti-Semitism. So Richard Rand, the translator of Glas in the back, and he says vegetarianism. You know, vegetarianism is something that could in no way be considered to be anti-Semitic. So I know. Derrida smiles again, and okay, he doesn't evoke Hitler, who's a famous vegetarian, but he says, I've been thinking a lot about vegetarianism recently. One of my friends became vegetarian. Insofar as the Judaic tradition requires the notion of sacrifice, on a formal level, vegetarianism is anti-Semitic. Okay. Now, I've always thought this is kind of fantastic because it doesn't mean every vegetarian is an advanced anti-Semitic. It means that when you're over here and you think you're very far away from what you think goes in the direction of the worst, watch out. Because the way in which you're thinking can have relays with what maintains and supports what goes in the direction of the worst. Right? The last anecdote is just something that I always ask my students too, which is I asked them to imagine what a politics based on the model of tears would look like. And they kind of look at me the way some of you are looking at me now. But I think, you know, I say, when you think about how to act politically, you look at a situation, you evaluate it, and on the basis of that evaluation, you decide what to do. So acting politically is generally based on a model of vision. You look, you evaluate, and you act. But a politics based on the model of tears is different, because when you're crying, you can't see things clearly. Right? So politics based on a model of tear implies that you always act without seeing things clearly, and in fact, you always act with tears in your eyes. And when you're witnessing someone crying, what you're really seeing is that self melting, so that it also requires a theory of subjectivity in which the subject is never the same from one moment to the next. And I think that much of what we've been talking about in terms of how to install different kinds of strategies. One of the warnings, let's say, that some of us have signaled, Ava and so on, is that we don't know. We are always proceeding without knowing whether what we do will bring about the end that we want. And that's why we have to continually do it again and again and again. Right? We have to remain as vigilant as possible in relation to the things that have gone into the making of who we are and have inscribed us within this network of relations that we always want to exceed in one another, but which we never can. So I think all we can do is, as you were saying, adjust, recontextualize, take on the contamination, but without knowing in advance what to do. I mean, I always feel as if I'm proceeding in the dark, sometimes by instincts like a wild animal, but never quite knowing whether what I'm doing
and
will bring
out
what I want.
And you mean not knowing if it's cosmetic or if it's structural, if the adjustment is a cosmetic
right.
adjustment or if it's
right.
a structural adjustment.
Right.
One has to abandon that anxiety in a way.
Abandon
that anxiety.
I don't think one can ever abandon anxiety.
But that particular anxiety.
Yeah. Well, if we're going to close, then I want to thank you, all of you. I'll end by saying something else. No, is that I actually think that the work I do, I mean, as a reader, a writer, and even though I collaborate with different people at different moments, is in the long run a very lonely work. And for me, I think what has always confirmed me in the madness of doing this work is having conversations with people I love or can care about things that matter to them and to matter to me. So I thank you for this, too. Mm-hmm.